behind it, neither fear, triumph, nor surprise. It was just a noise, loud and pointless, as though his mouth had been left tuned to a dead channel. Kicking and clawing, he slid over the edge of the suspension chamber, and nobody caught him this time. The hard impact brought him back to himself properly, to find he was lying on the floor of Key Crew, feeling not only like a fool, but a fool in pain and with an audience. There were three other people there, who had stepped back prudently as he flailed his way to freedom. For a moment he didn't even want to look at them. They might be mutineers. They might be weird Guyanites here to offer him up to their dead but ever-living cybernetic god. They might be spiders in disguise. It seemed to him that there was precious little good that could come of there being other people around him just then. "Classicist Dr. Holston Mason?" said a voice, a woman's voice. "Do you answer to your name?"
"Yes. What?"
The question was on the pivot point between normal and strange.
"Note that as a positive," a man said.
"Dr. Holston Mason, please stand up. You are being relocated. There is no cause for alarm, but your suspension chamber has become unstable and is in need of repair." Nothing in this speech made any acknowledgement of the fact that these clowns had just had to rip the lid off his coffin to get at the meat within. "You'll be taken to another chamber and returned to suspension. Or, if no functioning chamber is available, you will be taken to temporary accommodation until one is. We understand that this must be distressing for you, but we assure you that everything is being done to restore normal ship operation." At last, Holston looked up at them. They were wearing ship suits, and that had to be a good thing. He had half expected them to be dressed in hides and skins, a doubly unpleasant thought, given that the Gilgamesh had only one animal in abundance. They were two women and one man, and they looked surprisingly neat and clean. For a moment he could not work out why that alarmed him so. Then he clicked that, had this been some random emergency, and if these were crew, he would have expected them to be dishevelled and tired about the eyes and for the man to be unshaven. Instead, they had taken the time to smarten themselves up. The ship suits, on the other hand, were plainly not new, worn and scuffed and patched again. "What's going on?" The man who had reeled off his reassuring little speech opened his mouth again, but Holston put up a hand to stop him, hauling himself to his feet.
"Yes, yes, I got it.
What's going on?" "If you would come with us, Dr. Mason," one of the women told him. He found his hands had formed pathetic little fists and he was backing away.
"No, no. I've had enough of being hauled out every century by another band of half-wit clowns who've got some stupid idea of what they want to do, without telling me anything. You tell me what's going on, or I swear I'll...
And that was really the problem, because he'd what? What would the great Holston Mason then do? Would he throw a tiny tantrum out here in the vastness of space? Would he go back to his lidless coffin and fold his arms across his chest and pretend to be sleeping the sleep of the dead?
So help me, he tried again, but his heart wasn't in it.
The three of them exchanged glances, trying to communicate by grimace and eyebrow. At least they were not trying to haul him anywhere by force just yet. He cast a desperate glance around Key Crew to see what there was to see. At least half the suspension chambers were lying open, he saw. Some others remained closed, the panels on their exteriors displaying the cool blue glow of good functioning. Others were shading into green, and even towards the yellow that his own had perhaps been displaying. He went over to one, looking down at the face of a man he thought he recalled as being on Cast's team. The panels had a host of little alerts indicating what Holston assumed was probably bad news at some level. "Yes," one of the women explained, noting his gaze. "We have a lot of work to do. We have to prioritize. That's why we need you to come with us." "Look," Holston leant forwards to peer at the name on her ship suit. "Aelin, I want to know what the situation is with the Gil and..." "You're not Aelin." Because abruptly he remembered the real Aelin, one of the science team, a sharp-faced woman who hadn't got on much with Vetus or with anyone else. He was backing away again. "How long is it?" he demanded of them.
"Since when?"
They were advancing on him slowly, as if trying not to spook an excitable animal,
fanning out around the broken coffin to pin him. Since Guyon... But they wouldn't know. Probably they didn't even remember who Guyon was, or perhaps he was some demon figure in their myth cycles. These people were shipborn, Gilgamesh's children. All that smooth patter, the ship suits, the appearance of neat competence, it was all an act. They were nothing but monkeys aping their long-vanished betters. The new suspension chamber they would take him to, after destroying the real thing, would be nothing but a box with a few wires attached to it, a cargo cult coffin built by credulous savages. He looked around for something to use as a weapon. There was nothing to hand. He had a mad idea of waking up others of the key crew, of popping out the security man like some sort of guardian monster to scare them away. He had a feeling that his persecutors were unlikely to wait patiently while he worked out how to do it. "Please, Dr. Mason," one of the women asked patiently, as though he was just some confused old man who wouldn't go back to his bed.
"You don't know who I am!"
Holston yelled at them, and then he ducked and somehow came up, holding the whole jagged hinged lid of the suspension chamber, the unbalancing weight of it a weird reassurance that there was something solid in the world that he had control over. He threw it. Later, he would look back with amazement, watching this raging stranger he had briefly become, heaving the ungainly missile over the open coffin towards them. He got it bang on target, striking their upraised arms, knocking them out of the way. And then he rushed past them, sleep suit flapping open at the back as he dashed out of key crew. There was absolutely nowhere he could think of heading, so he just went, stumbling and staggering and pelting down the corridors that he remembered, but that had been transformed in his absence into something strange and broken. Everywhere there were wall panels removed, wiring exposed, some of it ripped out or cut through. Someone had been flaying the Gilgamesh from the inside, exposing its organs and inner workings at countless junctures. Holston was irresistibly put in mind of a body giving way to the last virulent stages of some disease. There were two people ahead of him, yet more manicured savages in orange shipsuits. They had been tinkering with a mess of tangled wiring, but stood up abruptly at the shouts issuing from behind Holston. He would have to go through them, he knew. At this stage, his only hope was to keep running, because that might at least get him somewhere other than this. This was not a place he could be. This was all too clearly a great and delicate space vehicle that was being torn apart from the inside. And how could any of them last after that? What happened? He was asking himself frantically. Lane was working to contain the Guyon infection. There was nothing I could do. I had to go back to sleep in the end. So how did it come to this? He felt that he was developing some hitherto unknown ailment, some equivalent of motion sickness caught from too many dissociated moments of history, crammed into too little personal time. Is this the end, then? Is this the human race in the end? He got ready to put his shoulder up against the two primitives ahead of him, but they refrained from getting in his way, and he just stumbled on past them as they stared at him blankly. For a moment he saw himself through their eyes, a wild-eyed old man bouncing off the walls, with his arse hanging out.
"Dr. Mason, wait!"
they were calling from behind him, but there was no waiting permitted to him. He ran and he ran, and eventually they cornered him in the observation cupola, with the star field drifting behind him, as though he was about to hold them off by threatening to jump. There were more than three of them by then. The commotion had brought along maybe a dozen, more women than men, and all of them unfamiliar people in old shipsuits with dead names on them. They watched him cautiously, even though there was nowhere else he could go. The three who had woken him were notably neater than the rest, whose garments and faces looked decidedly more lived in. "Welcoming committee," he thought dryly. "Awards for the best-dressed cannibals of whatever stupid year this is."
"What do you want?"
he demanded breathlessly, feeling himself at bay against the universe.
"We need to reallocate you a chamber,"
started the man from the welcoming committee, in those same bright, calm, false tones.
"No," said one of the others. "I told you, not this one. Special instructions for this one."
"Oh, of course."
So tell me, Holston broached to them. Tell me who you really are. You, he pointed at not Aelin. Who are you? What happened to the real Aelin that you're wearing her skin? Clothes, her clothes. He could feel a deep craziness trying to shake itself loose inside him. This crowd of serious, well-mannered people in stolen ship suits was beginning to frighten him more than the mutineers, more than the ragged robes of the cultists. And why was it always like this? What's wrong with us? And only from their expressions did he realize that he had just spoken aloud, but the words wouldn't stop.
What is it about us that we cannot live together in this fucking eggshell ship without tearing at each other? That we have to try and control one another and lie to one another and hurt one another? Who are you that you're telling me where I have to be and what to do? What are you doing to the poor Gilgamesh? Where did all you freaks come from?
The last came out as a shriek that appalled Holston, because something in him seemed to have snapped beyond any control or repair. For a moment he stared at his audience of the young and alien, with his mouth open, everyone including himself waiting to see if more words would be forthcoming. Instead he could feel the shape of his mouth deforming and twisting, and sobs starting to claw and suck at his chest. It was too much. It had been too much. He who had translated the madness of a millennia-old guardian angel. He who had been abducted. He who had seen an alien world crawling with earthly horrors. He had feared. He had loved. He had met a man who wanted to be God. He had seen death. It had been a rough few weeks. The universe had been given centuries to absorb the shock, but not him. He had been woken and pounded, and the rigid stasis of suspension offered him no capacity to recover his balance. "Dr. Mason," said one of them, with that relentless, brutal courtesy, "we are engineering. We are crew." And the woman he had singled out added, "Aelin was my grandmother."
"Engineering?" Holston got out.
"We are fixing the ship," explained another of the youngsters, so very earnestly. This new information spun about inside Holston's skull like a flock of bats trying to find a way out. Engineering. Grandmother. Fixing. "And how long will it take?" he said shakily. "To fix the ship."
"As long as it takes," said Aelin's granddaughter.
Holston sat down. All that strength, the rage and the righteousness and the fear, it all drained from him so viscerally that he felt he should be surrounded by a visible pool of spent emotions.
"Why me?" he whispered.
"Your suspension chamber required urgent attention. You had to be retrieved," said the welcoming committee man. "We were going to find you somewhere to wait while a new chamber was prepared, but now..." He glanced at one of his fellows.
"Special instructions," one of the newcomers confirmed.
"Let me guess," Holston broke in. "Your chief wants to see me."
He could see he was right, although they stared at him with something approaching superstition.
"It's Lane, isn't it?"
he said confidently. And the words unleashed a sudden jagged onset of doubt. My grandmother, not Aelin, had said. And where was Aelin now?
"Issa Lane?" he added, hearing a renewed tremble in his voice.
"Tell me." In their eyes he could see himself, a terrified man out of his time.
"Come with us,"
they urged him. And this time he went. Chapter 6.3 Communion. Bianca has spoken to the messenger before, and she has taken on a set of understandings donated by researchers who have distilled the wide history of contact with the artificial god into an easily analysed format. To Bianca, the results are fascinating, and she is not sure any other before her has come to quite the same conclusions. The messenger is plainly a sentient entity orbiting her world at a distance of around 300 kilometres. The earliest extant understandings record that, for an unknown period of time, the messenger was sending a radio signal to the world consisting of a series of mathematical sequences.
A relatively short time ago, historically speaking, an answering transmission was sent out by one of Bianca's forebears, and a strange and unsatisfactory dialogue commenced. It is the character of this dialogue that Bianca has been obsessing over. She is mulled over the second-hand experiences of those who came before, felt their distant conviction that the curious voice they heard belonged to some manner of intelligence, one that was deeply interested in her kind, intent on communicating, and that had a wider purpose. These conclusions seem unarguable from the facts. Bianca is also aware, from the understandings she has known, that her ancestors constructed a number of beliefs that are, in retrospect, less verifiable. Many came to believe that the messenger was responsible for their existence, a belief that their god actively fostered. Furthermore, they believed that the messenger had their best interests at heart, and that the plan they were following so diligently, and later at such cost, was one that, could they only understand it, was for their express benefit. Bianca has considered all of that and finds none of it supported by fact. She is aware that a great many of her species are still invested in Temple and the belief that the messenger is in some way looking out for them, even though that belief is only a wishful shadow of the fervour that once existed. She has been relatively tactful about her conclusions, therefore, but she has made it plain that the traditional, antiquated view of the messenger as something like their own kind, writ large, some great spider in the sky, is absurd. That the messenger is an entity of great breadth of intellect, she cannot contest. Potentially, it is a superior intellect. But that is a harder judgment to make, because she can only conclude that it is a very different type of intelligence from her own. There is plainly a vast amount that the messenger takes for granted, which even Bianca, stretch her mind as she might, cannot grasp. Conversely, there is much that has been said to the messenger that has evidently been misunderstood, or met with blank incomprehension on the part of God. The capabilities of the divine are apparently limited in curious ways. There are concepts that the most ignorant spiderling would intuitively understand that clearly pass the messenger by. And this, of course, is with a common language painstakingly hammered out between the two ends of the twitching radio waves. Ergo, as Bianca is not the first to consider, the messenger is far from all-seeing or all-knowing. It must feel its way. It must work to understand. And all too often, it fails. Where comprehension is most lacking is in basic everyday matters. The messenger is plainly unaware of most events occurring on the world it orbits. Moreover, descriptive language is usually lost on it. It is able to deal with visual descriptions in relatively basic ways, but any language coloured by the rich sensorium of a spider, the touch, the taste, tends to lose itself in translation. What is received most readily is numbers, calculations, equations, the stuff of arithmetic and physics. Bianca is familiar with that sort of communication from other sources. Out in the sea is a thriving civilization of crustaceans that her species has been in sporadic contact with for centuries. A basic gestural language has been negotiated over the years, and the submerged stomatopod state has experienced its own dramas and crises, its upheavals, coups and revolutions. Now they have radio, and scientists of their own, albeit their technology is constrained by their environment and their limited ability to manipulate that environment. They are a world apart, though, not just in being aquatic, but in their priorities and concepts. The one thing that Bianca can discuss with them readily is mathematics, something for which the stomatopods have a passion. She has spent many years refining and elevating the complex architecture of the ant colonies in order to create the tools she needs for her cutting-edge experimentation. The most complex systems, such as the self-regulating flight control colony aboard the Skynest, work on highly mathematical principles, and their chemical architecture is able to receive numerical information and act upon it, even to performing intricate calculations played out in ant bodies and the neurons of individual ant brains. Bianca is living with a recurring thought concerning the theoretical similarity between the messenger and an ant colony grown sufficiently advanced and complex, Would it feel the same to communicate with both? These days, active communication with the messenger is strictly limited. There are always odd sects, recidivist peer houses who have somehow nurtured and become consumed by a deviant understanding. As any reply from the messenger is received wholesale across most of the planet, such closet zealots are quickly uncovered and hunted down the moment it becomes apparent that someone has opened an unauthorized channel to God. Instead, the major cities each have a say in who has access to the messenger. Some temples, notwithstanding, attempt to find the divine truth behind the bewildering plan that is still broadcast entreatingly from time to time. Mostly, though, the privilege falls to inquiring scientists, and Bianca has schemed, plotted, flattered, and performed favours to buy herself the chance for a free and frank exchange of views. The Skynest is making good progress on its historic mission, rising steadily into the atmosphere. The onboard colony reports on its own radio frequency to Bianca, confirming that all is well, and data from three other distant transmitters triangulate the airship's position. This is the easy stage of the journey. Barring unforeseen weather, the Skynest should reach its effective operational ceiling on schedule. The messenger will be clearing the horizon, and Bianca sends a signal to her, inviting dialogue. She includes a certain amount of the formalities that Temple once used, not because she believes there is any need for them, but because God is better disposed towards those who feign the right humility. The messenger is patient enough to outlast generations of Bianca's kind, and her thoughts have a momentum that does not take note of developments on the world below, or so runs the theory. Bianca is not so sure. It is certainly a matter of fact that, despite the fall in Temple's fortunes, the messenger continues to exhort its congregation to work further on its machine. The demands have become all the more insistent since Bianca's peers of a generation or so ago essentially ceased to make progress on any literal translation of the messenger's desires, neither faith nor ingenuity being able to bridge the gap between divine will and mortal comprehension. Bianca is well aware of the threats and imprecations that have come from on high. The messenger has preached the coming of a terrible catastrophe. These days, Bianca's peers believe that this is little more than a crude attempt to motivate them into throwing further resources at an impossible errand. Again, Bianca is not so sure. She has a gift for seeing problems from unusual angles and imagining radical possibilities. The difficulty now, she believes, is not understanding the messenger, but getting the messenger to understand her. She needs to break through what appears to be a deeply ingrained train of thought. Historical example, remembered blurrily through the medium of understanding, shows that the messenger was not always so single-minded. Obsession or frustration have made her so. Or perhaps desperation, Bianca reflects. She intends to show the messenger something new. One of the giants whose shoulders she stands on is a still-living colleague who has bred a colony of seeing ants. Their sight is feeble compared to the spider's own, but the individual pinpoints of what the colony perceives can be assembled, by fearful mathematical effort, into a complete picture. Moreover, this picture can be encoded into a signal. The code is simple. A sequence of dark and light dots spiraling outwards from a central point that together build up into a wider picture. It is as universal a system as Bianca can conceive of. She has just such an encoded image that has been received into her working colony. Appropriately, it is a view of the Skynest itself, viewed just as it was lifting away from the city. She tells the messenger that she intends to transmit a picture. There is no obvious sign that she has been understood, since God's needy tirade continues unabated, but Bianca can only hope that some part of the celestial presence understands. She then instructs her colony to transmit, knowing that several hundred of her species' top scientists will be listening in on any reply. The messenger falls silent. Bianca cannot contain her excitement, and she races frantically around the silken walls of the room. Whilst it's not the reaction she was hoping for,
It is at least a reaction. Then the messenger speaks, requesting clarification. The scientific world holds its breath. God has understood, at least, that something new is in the air, and has replied in that odd, unemotional style that Bianca recalls from antique conversations when she was teaching this common language to her chosen. This is God, at her most procedural, seeking to understand what has just been received. Bianca tries and tries again. The messenger can grasp that the information transmitted is intended to be a visual image, but decoding it seems insurmountable. In the end, Bianca breaks down the task into its simplest elements, bringing the whole operation as close to that universal mathematics as she can by sending out formulae to describe the spiral that is the blindingly obvious way the image should be read. Bianca can almost feel the moment when the fulcrum of God's awareness tilts. A moment later, the response arrives, and she learns that God's language already contains a word for airship. By this time, the messenger has passed beyond the horizon, but God is insatiable. Show me more, is the unmistakable meaning. But Bianca transmits to her peers, cautioning them from further feeding the fire just yet. Privately, she is jealous of her newfound privilege in finally cracking the composure of God. She could continue speaking to God across the far side of the planet, bypassing her signal hand to hand across other transmitters until it could be sent out towards space once again. But she is willing to wait until God returns to communicate directly with herself, and her peers grudgingly defer to her suddenly elevated eminence. The messenger bombards the planet insistently for more information, during which time Bianca comes to a startling conclusion. That the messenger cannot see what goes on upon the planet right beneath her. Far from being all-seeing, and despite being readily familiar with the concept of sight, the messenger is blind. Radio is her only means of sight. Bianca has another picture sent to her ant colony, and she transmits it as soon as God returns to the skies above her. It is a simple enough sight, a view of 7 trees from within, showing the intricate splendour of its scaffolding and the bustling industry of its inhabitants. The developer of the encoded picture originally used it as a test image in her experiments. God is silent. Far distant, the sky nest finally reaches the heights it was designed for, and finds equilibrium in the upper reaches of the air, its gas bag now expanded to 0.5 kilometre in length. Bianca absently monitors its progress, knowing that the ship's crew will be testing their mechanisms and colony conditioning in the thin air, ensuring everything is ready for the most dangerous part of the mission, to be undertaken by Portia. Despite the double-hulled insulation of the cabin, the cold is causing some discomfort. Their species has some ability to regulate its body heat and keep its metabolic rate up, but they still grow sluggish whenever the temperature drops. Viola, in charge of the mission, reports that the work is going more slowly than anticipated, but is proceeding within tolerance. Bianca is still waiting. The progress of the sky nest is now of secondary concern. She has silenced the messenger. Nobody in all the history of her kind has done the like. The eyes of the world are on her, with a judgmental gaze. So she waits. Chapter 6.4 Epiphany. High above the green world, high above the sky nest and all the other industrious endeavours of its inhabitants, Dr. Avrana Kern tries to come to terms with what she has just been shown. She has seen these things before, these scuttling, spinning monsters. The drone sent from the Gilgamesh saw one briefly, before its demise. Cameras from the shuttle that she downed caught sight of some before it burned. She has known that there were things, unintended things, down on Kern's world, the serpents in her garden. They were not part of the plan, the ecosystem so carefully designed to provide a home for her chosen. She has known for lifetimes that they were there, but she has found within herself an almost infinite capacity to overlook. She can reel back in horror one moment, demanding, "What have you done with my monkeys?" And a mere decade later she has almost forgotten. Hidden subroutines coating this offending memory until it no longer irritates the oyster of her mind. The electronic interior of the sentry pod is cluttered with such cast-off memories, the understandings that she cannot bear to have as part of herself. They are lost thoughts of the home that she will never see. They are pictures of arachnid monsters. They are images of a barrel burning as it strikes atmosphere. All gone, excised from her functioning mind, and yet not lost. Eliza never throws anything away. Avrana has always returned to the certainty that her plan for this world has succeeded. What else is there for her, after all? For untold ages she has orbited in silence, broadcasting her never-ending examination questions at a heedless planet. For untold ages she slept, the robust systems of the sentry pod doing their diligent best to stave off the inching encroachment of decay and malfunction. Whenever Avrana awoke, at longer and longer intervals, screaming and clawing at the inside of her tiny domain, it was to cringe before an indifferent cosmos. The pod systems themselves, running on minimal power, did their best to keep everything going, but still there were sacrifices. She is blind, she is fragmented, she is not sure where she ends and where the machines begin. The pod is playing host to a multitude, each subsystem devolving into some crude autonomy, a community of the half-witted holding everything grimly together. And she is one of those shards. She occupies a virtual space, crowded and cramped as a rookery. She and Eliza and the many, many systems. The passing of the Gilgamesh, with all that undignified shouting and begging, even down to the colossal energy expenditure it took to bring their intruding shuttle down, it seems like a dream now, as though the would-be humans had wandered in from some parallel reality that had so very little to do with her. All they had taught her was that she had not known despair until they arrived. A silent planet was preferable to a planet bustling with human life, for human life would preclude the success of her mission entirely. Let her circle the globe until the sentry pod fell apart, so that still she could hope her monkey subjects would eventually call out to their creator. An absence of success did not mean her experiment was a failure. At no time has she examined her motives or priorities, or asked herself why she is so rigidly dedicated to carrying out this mission to the exclusion of all else. While she was speaking with those alleged humans from the Ark ship, it was almost as if she was two people. One that remembered what it was like to live and breathe and laugh, and one that remembered the importance of scientific success and achievement. She wasn't sure where that first Avrana had come from. It didn't seem like her somehow. Then the monkeys had answered, and everything changed. True, they were late. The projected few centuries had been and gone, and the sentry pod was long past the lifespan its creators had envisaged for it. Still, they built things to last in those days. If the monkeys had needed their hundreds or even their thousands of years, Avrana and Eliza and their myriad support systems were ready for them. But they had been so dense, and their thinking had been so strange. She had tried and tried, and so often seemed to be getting somewhere, but the monkeys had their own ideas, and such strange ideas. Sometimes they could not understand her superior intellect. Sometimes she could not understand them. Monkeys were supposed to be the easy first step to a universe of uplift. Everyone had assured her they would be close enough to humans to understand, yet far enough to remain a valid and worthwhile subject. Why could she not see eye to eye with them? Now she sees their eyes. She sees all eight of them. The image sent to her is insane, fantastical, a vast, layered, tangled structure of lines and links and enclosed spaces that exist only because they have been pulled into temporary arrangements of tension. The spiders are all about it, caught in mid-creep. The words that heralded this image were simple, clear, beyond mistaking. This is us. Avrana Kern flees into the limited depths of her remaining mind and weeps for her lost monkeys and knows despair, and she does not know what to do. She consults with her council of advisers, the others who share her deteriorating habitat.
Individual systems tell her that they are still doing their jobs. The main control is keeping a log of transmissions sent from the surface. Others record the progress of celestial bodies flagged as of interest, including a distant, a very distant, speck that calls itself the last hope of the human race. She presses further, seeking that other large focus of calculation she shares this pod with, and must occasionally negotiate with. They are legion in there, but there are two poles to the Bryn 2's sentry pod, and she reaches for the other carefully.
Eliza, I need your assistance.
Eliza, this is Avrana. She touches the stream of that other mind, and is momentarily immersed in the tumbling river of thought constantly flowing there.
My monkeys, where are my monkeys? Cannot help me now. I'm cold, so cold, and Eliza never comes to see. I can't see, can't feel, can't act. I want to die, I want to die, I want to die.
The thoughts flowing, helpless and unconstrained, out of that broken mind, as though it is trying to pour itself empty. And yet there is always more. Avrana recoils, and for a terrible, frozen moment, knows that if what she has touched is an organic mind, then I must be. But she has, after all, an almost infinite capacity to overlook, and that moment of self-reflection is gone, and along with it any threat of revelation. She is left merely with that intolerable image, reconstructed pixel by pixel inside her mind. This is what she has been communicating with. The monkey mask has been lifted, and that appalling visage is revealed instead. Every hope she had for her grand project, quite literally the one thing in the universe left to her, is now dashed. For a moment she tries to imagine that her simian protégés are out there somewhere else, hiding from the festering civilization of the spiders. But her memory has had enough of playing games. They burned. She remembers now. The monkeys burned. But the virus itself got through. That is the only explanation. Oh, perhaps what she has seen could arise spontaneously, given millions of years of the right conditions. The virus is the catalyst to condense all that span of time into mere millennia, though. The agent of her triumph has become instead the agent of something weird and strange. She tilts on the fulcrum of decision. She sees clearly the path of rejection. Those squabbling ape-things of the Gilgamesh will return eventually and make an end of it all in that mindless way that humans always have done. Monkeys or spiders, it will not matter to them. And she, Avrana Kern, forgotten genius of an elder age, will slowly decay into senescence and obsolescence, orbiting a world given over to the thriving hives of what she must nominally allow to be her own species. Her long history will be done. This last corner of her time and her people will be overwritten with the fecund hosts of her distant and undeserving descendants. All of it will be lost, and there will be no record of her long and lonely eons of waiting and listening, of her breakthroughs and her triumphs, and her eventual horrifying discovery. There are few immutable boundaries inside the sentry pod. The various entities, electronic and organic, have no firm divisions anymore, each leaning on and borrowing from the others for simple everyday functionality. Similarly, the past bleeds into the present at the slightest invitation. Avrana Kern, or the thing that considers itself to be her, relives her history with the green planet and its denizens, their mathematical reply, teaching the monsters to speak, her painful, difficult conversations, their worship, their entreaties, the baffling, half-incomprehensible tales they told her of their exploits. She has spoken with uncounted numbers of their great minds, votaries and astronomers, alchemists and physicists, leaders and thinkers. She has been a cornerstone of a civilization. No human being has ever experienced what she has, nor touched anything so alien. Save that they are not alien, of course. In the end, undeniably, their stock arose alongside hers. She and they share ancestors 500 million years old, before the stuff of life separated into those who would forever carry their nerves upon their back, and those that would carry them within their belly. There are no aliens that her people ever met or heard from. Or if there were, their signals were overlooked, passed by. Alien in a way that meant no human could see them and recognize them as evidence of life from elsewhere. Kern's faction, and her ideology, already knew this, which was why they intended to spread Earth life across the galaxy in as many varied forms as possible. Because it was the only life they had a responsibility to help it survive. She has lived lifetimes along with the people of the Green Planet. She and her host of companion systems have soared on their triumphs, shaken under their defeats, sought always to bridge what has ever been a troubled and incomplete understanding. She sees them now. Yes. She sees them for what they are. They are Earth. Their form does not matter. They are her children. She backtracks, calling up logs of centuries of conversations from where they are crammed into her electronic memories, having overwritten all the last desperate radio songs of old Earth. She reviews all the baffling mystery of the monkey dialogues now seen under a harsh and uncompromising new light. She stops trying to tell them things and starts listening. Much as the spiders can use their understandings to write new knowledge into their minds, though Kern has no idea of this, so Kern's current state means that she can rewire her own mind far more readily than a human brain could be reconditioned. She models generations of conversations, changes her perception of the senders, ceases trying to cast her protégés as something one step down from human. She understands, not perfectly, for great swathes of their talk remain a mystery, but her comprehension of what they are saying, their preoccupations, their perceptions, all of it, suddenly falls that much more into place. And at last, she answers them. I am here. I am here for you. Chapter 6.5 Things Fall Apart. They gave him a ship suit. He could hardly present himself in his flimsy sleeping garb, open at the back where the tubes had gone in, for all he had already paraded his pockmarked old backside through half of the crew quarters before they caught him. The name on his new outfit was Mallory. Searching his fragmented memory, Holston had no idea who Mallory might have been, and did not want to think about whether there was even a Mallory any more. Would he prefer to be wearing the clothes of a corpse, or those of someone who might any moment wake up and need them back? He asked after his own suit, but apparently it had been taken away and worn out long ago. When they were getting him clothes, he saw other people. This generation's engineers left him in one of the science rooms that had been converted into a dormitory. At least 40 people were crammed in there, the walls studded with hooks for hammocks that a few were still sleeping in. They looked frightened and desperate, like refugees. He spoke with a few. When they found out he was actually crew, they bombarded him with questions. They were insistent. They wanted to know what was going on. So did he, of course, but that answer did not satisfy them. For most of them, their last memory was of a poisoned, dying old Earth. Some even refused to believe how much time had gone by since they had closed their eyes in the suspension chambers that first time. Holston was appalled at how little some of these SKPs had actually known about the endeavour they were embarking on. They were young. Most of the cargo would need to be young, after all, to be able to start anew in whatever circumstances they were thawed out for. "I'm just a classicist," Holston told them. In truth, there were a thousand things he knew that would be relevant to their predicament, none of which he felt like talking about or thought would much reassure them. The most important question, that of their immediate future, he could not help with at all. Then the ersatz engineers came with the ship suit and led him off, against the complaints of the human cargo. He had his own questions then. He was feeling calm enough to deal with the answers. What will happen to them? The young woman who was leading him glanced grimly back the way they had come. Return to suspension as soon as chambers are available. And how long will that be? I don't know. How long has it been? He was picking up ample cues from her expression alone. The longest anyone has been out of suspension was 2 years. Holston took a deep breath. Let me guess,
There are more and more you're having to thaw out, right? Cargo storage is deteriorating. We're doing all we can, she snapped defensively. Holston nodded to himself. They can't manage it. It's getting worse. So where... Look, the woman rounded on him. Her badge said Terrata, another lost, dead name. I'm not here to answer your questions. I have other work to get to after this. Holston spread his hands appeasingly. Put yourself in my position. Friend, I have enough trouble just being in my own position. And what's so great about you, anyway? Why the special treatment? He nearly responded with, Don't you know who I am? As though he was some grand celebrity. In the end, he just shrugged. I'm nobody. I'm just an old man. They passed a room of perhaps a score of children. A sight so unexpected that Holston stopped and stared and would not be moved on. They were aged around 8 or 9, sitting on the floor with pads in their hands, watching a screen. On the screen was Lane. Holston choked at seeing her there. There were other things, too. Three-dimensional models, images of what might be the Guild's schematics. They were being taught. These were engineers in training. Not Terrata tugged at his arm, but Holston took a step into the room. The students were nudging each other, whispering, staring at him, but he had eyes only for the screen. Lane was explaining some piece of work, demonstrating by example and expanded diagram how to enact some particular sort of repair. She was older, on the screen. Not the chief engineer, not the warrior queen, just Issa Lane, forever doing her best with the shoddy tools the universe gave her. Where do they... Holston gestured at the now fatally distracted children. Where do they come from? Friend, if you don't know that, then I'm not explaining it to you, Not Terrata told him acidly, and some of the kids smirked. No, but seriously, there are children, of course. She told him sharply. What did you think? How else were we going to keep the work going? And the cargo? He asked her, because he was thinking about those people stuck outside suspension for months, for years. By then she had managed to drag him away from the schoolroom, directing the students' attention back to the teaching display with a stern gesture. We have strict population controls, she told him, adding, We are on a ship, after all. As if this was some sort of mantra. If we need fresh material from cargo, then we take it, but otherwise any excess production... And here her clipped, professional voice faltered just a little, touching on some personal pain so unexpectedly that Holston stumbled slightly in sympathy. Embryos are put on ice, to await future need, she finished, with a scowl at him to cover up her own awkwardness. It's easier to store an embryo before a certain point in its development than it is a full human being. Again, this sounded like some rote-learned dogma that she had grown up with. I'm sorry, I... We're here. They had reached communications. Until he actually stood there, he had not realised where they were going. But what... Just go in. Not Terrata gave him quite a hard shove, and then she walked away. For a long time... Holston stood outside the door to comms, obscurely fearful of crossing the threshold, until at last the hatch slid aside of its own accord, and he met the gaze of the woman inside. He had not known what to expect. He had thought there might be no living being at all, just a face on a screen that was perhaps something like Lane's death mask, perhaps with taints inherited from Guyan and Avrana Kern and who knew what else that was rattling about in the system. If not that... Then he had been terrified that what would meet his gaze might be something like Guyan had become, a withered lich that had once been human, sustained by and inseparable from the mechanisms of the ship itself, harbouring dreams of immortality in its curdling skull. To see the woman he had known curtailed to that would have been bad. Worse would be for the door to open and show him someone else entirely. But this was Lane, Issa Lane. She was older, of course. She must have been 15 years his senior by now, a veteran of the long battle against entropy and hostile computer intrusion that she'd been fighting on and off since they last parted. 15 more years would have been almost nothing to the people of the old empire. all the myths of that elder age confirmed that the ancients had lived far longer than a natural human span. In these reduced days, however, 15 more years had made Lane old. Not ancient, not decrepit, not yet. She was a working woman in the last days of her strength, staring down time's inevitable slope which would rob her of her abilities piecemeal with every step. She was heavier than she had been, and her face was written over in that universal human language of hardship and care. Her hair was grey, long, tied back in a severe bun. He had never seen her with long hair before. She was Lane, though, a woman he had seen evolve in snapshot over the course of so short a time for him, but a lifetime for her. He felt an upsurge of feeling in just looking at her face, the lines and weathering doing their best to hide her familiarity from him and failing. "Look at you, old man," she said faintly. She seemed as affected by his years as he was by hers. She was wearing a shipsuit with the name ripped off, a garment fraying at the elbows, patched at the knees. The ragged remains of another suit hung about her shoulders, reduced to something like a shawl that she fingered thoughtfully while looking at him. Holston stepped inside, looking at comms, noting two dark panels and one that had been gutted, but the rest of the station seemed to be operational. "You've been busy?" A nameless expression flickered across her face. "That's it, is it? All this time, and it's still the old flip remarks." He gave her a level look. "Firstly, it's not been all this time. Secondly, it was always you ready with the lip, not me." He was smiling as he said it, because that kind of banter he was used to from her was something he dearly wanted to hear just now. But she just stared at him as though he was a ghost. "You haven't changed." And as she said it, it was plain she knew how fatuous a remark it was, but still something she needed to get out. Holston Mason, historian, had now outlived the histories. Here he was, bumbling through time and space, making mistakes and being ineffectual, the one stable point in a moving universe. "Oh, fuck. Come here, Holston. Just come here." He didn't expect the tears, not from her. He didn't expect the fierce strength of her arms as she held him to her, the shaking of her shoulders as she fought against herself. She held him out at arm's length, and he was struck with how alien this situation must be for her. How normal for him to meet an old friend and find her changed and aged, and search the lines of her face for the woman she had been. How wrenching it must be for her to try and find the older man he might one day become in his untouched features. "Yes," she said at last. "I've been busy. Everyone's been busy. You've no idea how lucky you are that you get to travel freight." "Tell me," he encouraged her. "What? Tell me what's going on. Please, somebody, tell me something, at least." She lowered herself carefully into what had once been Guyon's seat, gesturing to another for him.
"What? Situation report? You're the new commander? The scholar doesn't like being kept in the dark?"
And that sounded so like the old, the young Lane, that he smiled.
"The scholar does not," he confirmed. "Seriously, of all the people left in the... on the ship, it's you I trust. But you're... I don't know what you're doing with the ship, Lane. I don't know what you're doing with these... your people here."
"You think I've gone like him?" No need to name any names there.
"Well, I wondered."
"Guyon fucked over the computer," she spat out. "All his upload nonsense. It went just about like I said it would. Every time he tried to grow, in there, it shut off more of the Guild's systems. I mean, a human mind, that's a fuckload of data. And there were 4 or 5 separate, incomplete copies fighting for space in there. So I set to work trying to contain them. Trying to keep the essentials running. Keeping the cargo cold, stopping the reactor getting too hot. You remember, that was the plan when you went under. Seemed like a good plan. I remember you said you'd be going into suspension yourself soon enough," Holston noted.
"That was the plan," she confirmed. "Only there were complications. I mean, we had to find cargo space for Guyon's crazies. Cast had great fun rounding them up and putting them on ice. And by then some of them were working with my people in keeping a lid on the hardware situation. And Guyan, the fucking Guyan archipelago strung out through the system, kept getting out, trying to copy itself, eating up even more space. We purged and we isolated and we set packs of viruses on the bastard, but he was seriously entrenched by then. And when my team was up and running and I had faith in them, I went under like I said I would. And I set myself a wake-up call. And when I woke again, things were worse. Guyan still? Yeah, still him. Still clinging on by his electronic fucking fingernails. But my people were finding all sorts of other shit going wrong too. Holston had always found Lane's swearing faintly shocking, but weirdly attractive in a taboo sort of way. Now, from her old lips, it was as though she had been practicing all those years for just this level of bitter world weariness. Problems from losing more cargo, and other systems going down that Guyan and his half-wit reflections weren't responsible for. There was a bigger enemy out there all along, Holston. We were just kidding ourselves that we'd got it beaten. The spiders? Holston demanded immediately, all of a sudden imagining the ship infested with some stowaways from the green planet, no matter how impossible that seemed. Lane gave him an exasperated look. Time, old man. This ship's close to 2,500 years old. Things fall apart. Time is what we're running out of. She rubbed at her face. The mannerism made her look younger, not older, as though all those extra years might just be scrubbed away. I kept thinking I'd got a lid on it. I kept going back to sleep, but there was always something else. My original crew, we tried taking it in shifts, parceling out the time. There was just too much work. I lose track of how many generations of engineers there have been now, under my guidance. And a lot of people didn't want to go back under. Once you've seen a few failed suspension chambers. Holston shuddered. You didn't think about upload? She eyed him sidelong. Seriously? You could watch over everything forever then, and still stay young. But he couldn't quite say that, and he had no other way of ending the sentence. Well, apart from adding to the computer problem about 100-fold, fine, she said. But it was plain that wasn't it. And it's just that copy, the upload, over all those years. I'd have set it on a task that would include killing itself off at the end. Leave no survivors in the mainframe. And would it? Because if it wanted to live, it could sure as hell make sure I died in my sleep. And would it even remember, in the end, who was the real me? There was a haunted look on her face that told Holston she had thought long and hard about this. You don't know what it's like. When those bits of Guyan got loose, when they hijacked the comms, listening to them. Even now I don't think the system's right. And the radio ghosts, mad transmissions from that fucking satellite or something. I don't know. And her shoulders slumped, the Iron Woman taking her mail off. When it was just him and her. You don't know what it's been like, Holston. Be thankful. You could have woken me, he pointed out. It was not the most constructive thing to say, but he resented being cast as the lucky survivor with no choice in the matter. When you woke, you could have woken me. Her gaze was level, terrible, uncompromising. I could. And I thought of it. I came so close you wouldn't believe, when it was just me and those know-nothing kids I was trying to teach my job to. Oh, I could have had you at my beck and call, couldn't I? My personal sex toy. She laughed harshly at his expression. In and out of sleep, and in and out of me, is that it? Well, I... Ah, well... Oh, grow up, old man. Abruptly, she ceased finding herself so funny. I wanted to, she said softly. I could have used you, lent on you, shared the burden with you. I'd have burned you up like a candle, old man. And for what? For this moment when I'd still be old, and you'd be dead? I wanted to spare you. I wanted to... She bit her lip. Keep you. I don't know, something like that. Perhaps knowing I wasn't putting you through this shit helped keep me going.
And now?
Now we had to wake you anyway. Your chamber was fucked. Irreparable, they tell me. We'll find you another.
Another?
Seriously, now that I'm out,
you go back.
I'll have you drugged and stuffed into a pod by force if I have to. Long way to go yet, old man.
When she smiled like that, a hard woman about to get brutal with whatever part of the universe stood in her way, he saw where a lot of the new lines on her face had come from.
Go where? He demanded. Do what? He demanded. Come on, old man, you know the plan. Guyon surely explained it to you.
Holston boggled.
Guyon? But he... you killed him.
Best crew appraisal ever,
she agreed, mirthlessly. But his plan, yes. And he was thinking that up without realizing how the ship was starting to fail. What else is there, Holston? We're it. This is us, the human race, and we've done really fucking well to make it this far against all the odds. But this piece of machinery simply cannot keep going forever. Everything wears out, old man. Even the Gilgamesh. Even me, was the unspoken thought.
The green planet, Holston finished. Avrana Curran. The insects and things.
So we burn them out a bit, get ourselves established. Hell, maybe we can domesticate the fuckers. Maybe you can milk a spider. If the bastards are big enough, maybe we'll be riding around on them. Or we could just poison the fucks, scrub the planet clean of them. We're humans, Holston, it's what we're good at. As for Curran, Guyon had put in most of the groundwork before. He spent generations fucking with the Gil, shielding the system from her. That old terraforming station she sent us to, it had all the toys. She can try taking over, and she can try frying us, and we'll be ready for both. And it's not like we have anywhere else to go. And as luck would have it, we're already on the way there. So it all lines up nicely.
You've got it all worked out.
I reckon I'll let Cast sort out the frontier spirit end of things, once we're there, she told him. I reckon I'll be ready for a rest by then.
Holston said nothing, and the pause lengthened uncomfortably. She did not meet his eyes. At last the words fought themselves free.
Promise me nothing, she snapped instantly. No promises. The universe promises us nothing. I extend the same to you. This is a human race, Holston. It needs me. If Guyon hadn't fucked us up so badly with his immortality scheme, then maybe things could have gone differently. But he did, and they haven't, and here we are. I'm going back to bed soon, just like you. But I'm setting my alarm early, because the next generation's going to need someone to check their maths.
Then let me stay with you, Holston told her fiercely. It doesn't sound like anyone's going to need a classicist any time soon. Or at all, ever. Even Guyon only wanted me as his biographer.
If you say grow old together, I'm going to thump you, Holston, Lane returned. Besides, there's still one thing you'll be needed for. One thing I need you to do.
You want your life story set down for posterity? He needled, as nastily as he felt able.
Yeah, you're right. I always was the funny one. So shut the fuck up.
She stood up, leaning against the consoles, and he heard her joints pop and creak.
Come with me, old man. Come and see the future.
She led him through the cluttered, half-unmade chambers and passageways of the crew area, heading towards what he recalled were the science labs.
We're going to see Vetus, he asked.
Vetus, she spat.
Vetus I made use of right at the start, but she's been sleeping the sleep of the not particularly trusted ever since. After all, she'd not soil her hands with maintenance. And I've not forgotten how she was egging Guyon on all the while before. No, I'm taking you to see our cargo extension.
You've put in new chambers. How?
Just shut up and wait, will you?
Lane paused, and he could see she was catching her breath, but trying not to show it.
You'll see soon enough.
In fact, he did not see when she eventually showed him. Here was one of the labs, and here, taking up much of one wall, was a specimen chamber. A great rack of little containers, hundreds of little organic samples kept on ice. Holston stared and stared and shook his head. And then
Just as Lane was about to lay into his lack of perception, he suddenly connected the dots and said,
"Embryos?"
"Yes, old man. The future. All the new life that our species couldn't stop itself putting out, but that we had no space to raise and bring up. As soon as some over-eager girl decides she wants a family that I, in my wisdom, don't think we can afford, it's out with the surgery, and it comes here. Harsh world, ain't it?"
"Alive?"
"Of course alive," Lane snapped at him. "Because right now I'm still hoping the human race has a future. And we're frankly still kind of short on people from a historical perspective. So, we put them on ice and hope that one day we can fire up the artificial wombs and bequeath a load of orphans to the universe."
"The parents must have..."
"Argued, fought, kicked and screamed." Her stare was barren. "Yeah, you could say that. But also they knew what would happen ahead of time. And they still did it. Biological imperative's a funny thing. The genes just want to squeeze themselves into another generation, no matter what. And, of course, we've had generations growing up here. You know how kids are. Even when you offer them countermeasures, they won't use them half the time. Ignorant little fucks, so to speak. I don't understand why you thought I so desperately needed to see all this," Holston pointed out. "Oh, yeah, right." Lane bent over the console and skimmed through various menus until she highlighted one of the embryo containers. "That one. See it?" Holston frowned, wondering if there was some mutation or defect that he was supposed to be noticing. "What can I say?" Lane prompted. "I was young and foolish. There was this lusty young classicist. He swept me off my feet. We had dinner by the light of dying stars in a 10,000-year-old space station. Oh, the romance." Her deadpan delivery never wavered. Holston stared at her.
"I don't believe you."
"Why?"
"But you never said. When we were up against Guyan, you could have..."
"Right then, I wasn't sure we had a future. And if Guyan had found out and got control of the system..." "It's a girl, by the way. She's a girl. Will be a girl."
And it was that repetition that told Holston how close to the edge Lane was now skating.
"I made the choice, Holston. When I was with you, I chose. I made this happen. I was going to... I thought there would be time later. I thought there would be a tomorrow when I could go back to her and... But there was always some other damned thing. The tomorrow I was waiting for never came. And now I'm not sure I..."
"Issa."
"Listen, Holston, you're going back under as soon as they find you a chamber, right? Your priority. Fuck all the rest. There are some perks to being me right now, and first off is that I call the shots. You go under. You wake up when we hit the green planet system. You make planetfall, and you make sure everything is done to make that place ours, come crazy computers or monster spiders or whatever. And you make it somewhere she can live. You hear me, old man?"
"But you..."
"No, Holston. This thing you get to take responsibility for. I'll have done all I can. I'll have done everything humanly possible to bring about this tomorrow. It'll be down to you after that." Only later, after she saw him to his newly restored suspension chamber, did he glimpse the name still tagged on the ragged shawl of shipsuit she wore about her shoulders. The sight of it froze him, just as he was about to get a leg up into the refurbished coffin.
"Really? For all this time?"
Facing that long, cold oblivion, with no certainty that he would wake up again, it was curiously warming to know that someone, even if it was this cynical, bitter woman, had been holding a torch for him all those unfelt years. Chapter 6.6 And Touched the Face of God. Portia wants to go out along with the rest of the crew, but Viola has forbidden it. She is being saved for her own private ideal. Until then, Portia is to be as cosseted and pampered as a sacrificial king. This high up, the Skynest's colony needs physical help to keep the airship envelope in shape, and to keep the ship maintained.
Even working from within, the cold is getting to the ants. Tiny and unable to regulate their own temperature, they cannot accomplish much outside the core of the ship itself. And so the spiders have donned their special suits and gone out to crawl about the exterior of their floating home, entering and leaving through pressure doors of their own weaving and reweaving, temporary airlocks appearing and disappearing as needed. They stumble and stutter back in twos and threes, their work done for the moment. Some return, bound to their comrades' backs, overcome by the cold, despite the layers of silk swathing their bodies and the chemical heaters slung beneath their bellies. Portia feels uncomfortable at not being able to assist, for all she understands that she is being saved for another ordeal. There were a few who had clung to the idea that being closer to the sun would be to feel its unmitigated heat. They have been roundly disabused of this notion. Up here, the thin air leeches at their bodies like a sightless vampire. And despite this, Portia would have joined them, worked knee to knee alongside them and pulled her weight.